From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in August 1985, San Francisco. 28-year-old Ken Baldwin was severely depressed, according to the New Yorker magazine, which chronicled his story. He told his wife not to expect him home until late. Then he drove to the Golden Gate Bridge and said to himself, quote, "I just want to disappear." That bridge is this nation's leading spot for suicide, and Baldwin was, sadly, one of hundreds who have gone to the bridge determined to die in recent decades. But his story is a cautionary tale for all of us, for people who consider suicide, for family and friends trying to understand what to do about it. On the bridge, Baldwin counted to 10, but froze. Then he counted to 10 again and said he was scared he wouldn't have the guts if he waited any longer. He jumped over the side, and the first thing that entered his mind in midair was this, quote, "I instantly realized that everything in my life that I thought was unfixable was totally fixable except for having just jumped." Baldwin was one of the few Golden Gate jumpers who survived. This summer, the Golden Gate Bridge Board approved $76 million for a large net to prevent suicides. Opponents said it was a waste of money and people considering suicide would go somewhere else. But supporters point out stories like Ken Baldwin's. When people attempt suicide but survive, there is hope. They are not guaranteed to try again. With support, they can move forward. And this is the hour where we want to talk about this issue, even if it can be uncomfortable. Shai Lewis is back in studio, manager of 211 Lifeline, a program of Goodwill of the Finger Lakes. Shai, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too. Thanks for having me back.
Joanne Moon is here. She's a volunteer for the Yellow Ribbon Suicide Prevention Program. Joanne, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Joanne's mom is Jean Lansbury, who is here. And not just Joanne's mom, which is probably a big job in and of itself, Jean, but the director of the Yellow Ribbon Program site at the Newark First United Methodist Church. Nice to see you, Jean.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
Let me start with Joanne and Jean and just ask that you're not just part of the Yellow Ribbon Suicide Prevention Program. You've gone through a lot yourself, and I'll start with you, Joanne. Just tell me a little bit about your own story.
In 2009, I lost my niece, Rachel, to suicide. And, of course, it was very unexpected, but in hindsight, the things we have learned, there was probably a lot more we could have done to have kept her here.
And since then, going on 5 years now, you're involved with this. I'm sure plenty of people will, well, if people do talk to you, some people may be uncomfortable to bring it up with you. But for folks who talk to you, what do you tell them about some of the sentiments, the emotions, the being afraid to confront things? I mean, it's a very complex set of issues there. But where do you start?
You start with taking them seriously. Mm-hmm. It's very important. Don't take anything lightly. If you feel someone is considering suicide, just be present, stay with the person, and listen, and direct them towards the Lifeline, towards Shai. That does help, just talking. And as far as from the survivor's standpoint, you have to let yourself know it's okay to not be okay. And we didn't know that we didn't get involved in Yellow Ribbon until, 2012? So it was 3 years that we didn't know what to do. And because the grief with suicide is different, it's complicated. You have to allow yourself to fall apart and put yourself back together before you can start grieving.
Do you deal with blame?
That goes through your mind, definitely.
And you have to learn not to, right? I mean, I guess that's part of what you're saying, right?
Yes, you do. Because once someone gets to that point where they've decided that that's the only answer, you know, you look back and say, why, what if, you know, so many questions. And those are questions that you have to accept you're not going to ever have the answer to.
Jean, your daughter speaks so beautifully about such a difficult subject, but what would you add to that?
Well, I just want to mention a writing that Doug Manning, the author of a continuing care series, wrote. The series is Will I Survive This Pain? And he writes that grief only comes in one size, and that's extra large. Mm. And it's like peeling an onion. It comes off one layer at a time, and you cry a lot. And now if each of us were given an onion, everyone would have a different onion. No two onions would be alike. And no two people would peel the onion in the same way because no two people grieve the same. Suicide, however, has a shattered dimension. And the onion is shattered by suicide. And the family seems to need to reconstruct that onion before they can even begin the peeling and actual grieving process. They need to understand each minute detail in an effort to piece the story together. Suicide has an intensified sense of guilt. Loved ones look at things they should have done or mistakes they might have made.
I think that's an amazing metaphor. And in that way, did talking to others through Yellow Ribbon, talking to other people, survivors of suicide, and by the way, when we say survivors of suicide, I don't know, and maybe Shai can jump in and tell me if that's, I think of the word survivor of suicide as someone has committed suicide and these are the loved ones left behind. Is that the right term?
That's exactly okay. Right. So we talk about survivors of suicide as people who have experienced the death of a loved one. If we're talking about someone who's attempted suicide, we often use the term attempt survivor, or we talk about someone with lived experience. Okay. So those are some of the terms that help us to talk about the scope of suicide.
All right. So Joanne and Jean are suicide survivors. And when you, I don't know when it was you first started talking to others who've been there, who are survivors themselves. What does that do for you, Joanne?
Oh, it helps a lot because it's a hard thing to talk about. No one wants to talk about it. And you know, I had points where, you know, if I don't talk about it, maybe it'll go away. Maybe I'll feel better. But that only made it worse. And the first time I realized that being around other survivors was different than even like my mom and my sister went to grief counseling and it wasn't suicide, it wasn't geared towards suicide loss. And it really didn't help them because it's so much different. And we went on the Walk for Life in, when did we do it? 2012.
May 2012.
Our first Walk for Life where we were actually with fellow people who had lost loved ones to suicide. And it was so comforting just to have normal people with the same problems, the same feelings to connect with. It was more therapeutic than the professional help. So we decided to start our own Survivors of Suicide support group because we found, after 3 years, we found out about Yellow Ribbon and we realized there were no support groups in our areas, none. And so we're like, we started our own support group. We meet once a month and still, you know, it's been 5 years for us. We still have lots to talk about. We get new people in and out and it's just connecting with people with similar experience helps.
I mean, that's the definition of an organization that no one wants to ever have to be part of, but once you're in that need, you need it. You really need it. And so if people want to get involved, Jean, how can they do that?
Well, you can contact Joanne or myself or Tammy Richardson, who is a Yellow Ribbon chapter leader in North Rose. She's the woman that we actually met through a mutual friend and began our journey with Yellow Ribbon. And on the Walk for Life, the first step we took at our first walk, we realized that we had to be more than survivors, that we had to be survivors in action. So we simply went online to yellowribbon.org, and we joined the organization. We started our own Yellow Ribbon program site. We distribute material, resource information, contact information for those who may be suicidal and those survivors that need help. We continue with the Survivors of Suicide Support Group. We're available to present the program anywhere if anyone would like to contact us. That's our goal, to keep presenting that program, to keep getting the word out that it's okay to ask for help. Many people think it's a weakness, but it's actually a strength because you value your life enough that you want to see a resolution.
Well, I don't know if it was Shai. I'm trying to remember. I had this conversation on this program before. It's amazing how they pile up and you lose sight of it. I don't know if it was when Shai was on last month after Robin Williams died, or if it was a different program entirely, but I was talking with someone about just the notion of therapy at all. And you know, whether it's a survivor of suicide or just in your own life, you know, I've got good friends and one of the strongest couples I know, and I found out they're going to couples counseling. I thought you guys were all right. And they said, no, that's the point. I said, you know, you don't take your car in for an oil change after you crash it. You get a regular tune-ups to make sure it stays good. And what's wrong with occasionally going to counseling, going to a therapist, just talking, even when things are good? So I don't know. So, Shai, what do you make of that?
The value of getting a third party to talk to you about what's going on in your life, no matter what you're struggling with, whether it's depression or another mental illness, whether thoughts of suicide are on your mind, whether it's normal ups and downs of daily living that we all have before things become a crisis, the value of having a third party to talk to that's not necessarily part of your stuff, not maybe part of your family or your support network, can't be underrated. It's really a great opportunity to have someone listen to what you're going through, give you some sound feedback, maybe some guidance on ways to cope or approaches. And that is so helpful to people at every spectrum of distress, from I'm feeling a little bit like these things are a struggle all the way up to I'm thinking about suicide. To have somebody to talk to is invaluable. And we should all be looking at our regular support networks, who are our family, our friends, our mentors that we can reach out to. But also, it's so valuable to have a therapist or to be able to reach out to a crisis line when you need a different perspective. So, and a different perspective is really, really helpful when you're struggling, when you're feeling like pain is unbearable and you're not sure where to turn.
We're talking about suicide. Wednesday was World Suicide Prevention Day. Is that right? It was Wednesday, and a lot of emphasis this week, this month, on suicide prevention. And we've got a panel helping us talk about it. And I know it's difficult to talk about, but if you want to share your questions, your thoughts, your own experiences, you can do that toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. If you prefer to do it sort of via electronic communication, I already have some of your comments and questions, and we're going to do it that way as well. But part of the point today is that it can be difficult to talk about, but there are times where it is vital to be willing to talk about it. And, you know, Shai, I started the hour with that amazing story. I read this article in The New Yorker called Jumpers, and listening to Ken Baldwin say that he jumps off the Golden Gate Bridge and instantly knows everything could have been fixed here. What have I done? And that to me is shocking, heartbreaking. I don't even know. I got a chill when I read that. And he survived it, and most people who jump off the bridge do not. But that also said to me, that's the experience of someone who is trying to commit suicide and instantly knows in that moment, if I get another chance at this, I can fix it. Even when it feels unfixable. What did that say to you?
Mm-hmm. It says that for many, many, many people, the vast majority of people, I think that there are solutions. They may not be the solution that you're thinking of, but there are possibilities and there is hope. And that was the voice of hope and the voice of life speaking as he made that jump. And we've talked to other through our hotline services and you know, through my career crisis intervention throughout the years, talked to other people who are attempt survivors and who have lived that experience of realizing after the attempt is in progress that they don't want to do it, that they don't want to die. That's not every person's experience, but it's an experience that a lot of people have. And it's so powerful when people with that lived experience talk. That message, that story that you told probably speaks to a lot of people in a way that hearing someone like me wouldn't.
Well, and before I get to the phones, Jill and Genesea, we're coming to you next. But let me follow up and ask you, do we know the number of, if someone survives an attempt of suicide, and I've already had this question online today, how likely are they to try it again?
I don't know that. I know the flip statistic. I know that generally a person who has attempted suicide is 3 times more likely to attempt again. But there's still, that's one statistic. There's a large number of people who have thoughts of suicide every day. There's people out there on the front lines battling these thoughts and winning against them every day. And their experience is so important to think about because they are coping, reaching out, talking. There are other folks who have attempted who will never attempt again and want to be part of the conversation about how to prevent future suicides.
Let me get to the phones. This is Jill in Geneseo. Jill, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for letting me speak to you. there's so many different things about this topic to talk about. My mother committed suicide on Christmas Day, 1986, so it's been a while. But the I guess what I wanted to talk about was the idea of guilt that you brought up before. And I think what's the thing that's, even all these years later, coming on 30 years after the event, you know, we can Monday morning quarterback all kinds of ways to try to understand why she did what she did, and she left notes, and we sort of have a little bit of idea of what she was thinking, and worked very hard, all of us in the family, on trying to expunge the guilt, you know, why didn't we see this coming, or if we had any inkling, why didn't we do so, and all those sorts of things. But you can rationalize that all you want, and I think it's impossible to ever feel that there wasn't something we could have done to prevent it. And that's just a really hard thing to live with. It runs parallel with being mentally healthy and having worked on myself and having thought about this an awful lot and really, really knowing that there wasn't, because I really do believe that most people, when they make their minds up to do it, they're going to do it. But I don't know. I mean, then I'll kind of go, yeah, but, you know, that time you were in the room with her when she looked at you and you saw, you know, sometimes they say that people, when they're about to suicide, you know, they have these incredible moments of clarity. And I think I was privy to one of those moments, or maybe I'm making it up, I don't know. But, you know, I feel like there was a moment when, if I had only said, are you okay? Are you, you know, like, let's, you know, if I'd reached out, that moment feels like that was the moment something could have been done. And maybe that's magical thinking, but I think that that's something a lot of us do as survivors. We just wonder, did we miss that time when, and I could have been the one, I could have been the savior, you know, did I miss that moment when I could have been the one to keep her from doing it?
And Jill, I will turn this over to the panel. I will say that your comments there remind me of, in that article I'm referring to, there was the story of a man who left a note for his family that said, I'm going to the Golden Gate Bridge to kill myself, and if one person smiles at me on my way to the bridge, I won't do it.
Yeah.
And he killed himself. And I'm sure it's easy to go, wow, I mean, you got to blame somebody here. And the instinct is there to blame. Let me ask our panel, and thank you so much, Jill, for the call. Chai, your reaction first to her comments.
Yeah, Jill, thank you so much for sharing your story. I think that Joanna Jean would agree with me when that your thoughts and your reaction and that sort of examining what happened over and over is part of, I'm going to use your metaphor, putting the onion back together again and thinking about it. And we do see some things in hindsight that may become more clear, but that's because now we have new information that we didn't have before. We know now by their suicide how they were feeling in a way that we couldn't have known before. So it is hard to not do that examination and to not look at maybe could I have done something differently. But we have to remember that that's coming from that perspective of not knowing at the time where they were at, and you maybe could have known. Most people who die by suicide generally give some kind of warning or invitation, but it's not always the kind that can be noticed or noticed by the right person. So it's really hard to think about blaming ourselves and more to think about how you can't be responsible for another person, even when you care so deeply for them. We can't make that choice for them.
And let me ask Joanne to also respond to that. Go ahead, Joanne.
I think I agree with everything Shai said, but that's why it's important that we try to end the stigma in talking about it so more people can recognize the signs and treat it as if it's not a choice. It's the end result of the turmoil that's going on. And people who die by suicide do not want to end their life. They want to end their pain. So recognizing the signs and getting them help for the pain that they're feeling so that they value their life is very important. And there is, like they call it, I've read articles on the suicidal trance, that once one makes up his mind that he wants to end his life, he's actually at peace with that. So, like, it could be days, weeks before that person's death, they seem better. They seem happy because they're at take comfort in, I'm not going to have to endure this pain any longer. So
I think that that's accurate. I think in our in the last comment I'll make, and then I'd like to feed it to other people for their comments too. But what you said that's really holds true is after it was all over, and I stayed with my dad for a few months to help him out, kind of emotionally, to get him so that I couldn't leave him alone. And he, one of those nights, one of the many nights where he's just like, why? And I just said, you know, I think, I don't know if this is helpful or not, but if we think of it from her point of view, how miserable she was for so long, this was her way of taking control and saying, I'm not doing this anymore. I don't think she wanted to leave us and not see us grow up and get married and have kids and be part of our, I don't think that's what she wanted, but I do think what she wanted was to not go through that pain anymore. And I think that having that lens of let's pretend to be her for a minute and like, I can't do this anymore, I'm not taking this anymore, it sort of put a little bit of I don't condone suicide, but in a sense it gave me respect for the fact that she felt she couldn't do anything else, and she took this into her own hands and said, I'm not doing this anymore. And we wish that there had been other interventions, but that's the only way that we could get to the point of, like, it's not that she didn't love us, it's not that she didn't want to live, yeah. She wanted to stop the pain. And I think that's really helpful. It's very helpful. And it helped my dad to think that way. But anyway, I'll get off and let other people talk. Thank
Jill,
you so much.
You've shared some... It. Yeah, thank you, Jill. You've shared a remarkable story there. And Jill's last point there, call to mind, we have a listener on Twitter who referred us to a quote from David Foster Wallace, a great writer who wrote about suicide before killing himself. And let me read what David Foster Wallace wrote. Again, every person's different and every experience is different, and not everyone agrees, but here's what David Foster Wallace wrote about this. The so-called psychotically depressed person who tries to kill herself doesn't do so out of, quote, hopelessness or any abstract conviction that life's assets and debits do not square, and surely not because death seems suddenly appealing. The person in whom the invisible agony reaches a certain unendurable level will kill herself the same way a trapped person will eventually jump from the window of a burning high-rise. Make no mistake about people who leap from burning windows. Their terror of falling from a great height is still just as great as it would be for you or me standing speculatively at the same window just checking out the view. The fear of falling remains a constant. The variable here is the other terror, the fire's flames. When the flames get close enough, falling to death becomes the slightly less terrible of two terrors. It's not desiring the fall. It's terror of the flames that have come so close. And yet nobody down on the sidewalk looking up and yelling, don't, and hang on, can understand the jump. Not really. You'd have to have personally been trapped and felt the flames to really understand a terrible way out there. That's David Foster Wallace. And so to the point there, it's not that someone wants to die. It's that they think it's the alternative to having to deal with the flames coming so close. And part of what we've been talking about, and Shai speaks so beautifully importantly about, is finding a way for those of us, and we're going to spend the second half hour looking at ways that we can reach out, not be afraid to talk, and not be afraid to say, you feel those flames, I'm going to help you. You know, we may not be able to put them all out right now, but they're not going to burn you. We're going to get there. You agree, Shai?
I do. I think that we've talked to a lot of, and in my career working in suicide hotlines, talked to a lot of people who share that perspective of pain, that unbearable feeling of pain for a variety of reasons. And every person's pain is different. But when it begins to feel unbearable, suicide becomes an option. And it's such a clear option that some of the other more gray areas become harder to listen to. And so reaching out for help by the person who is thinking of suicide can become such an important step. And it's hard to do. But if you can do it, talk to somebody. And if you're a family member or a loved one, we want to talk as we move on through this about some ways to recognize someone who might be at risk and how to start that conversation so that we can look at how we can end some of that pain. It's almost always, in my experience, someone who wants to end the pain, not that they want to die.
Yeah. Let's get one more quick call here, and then we're going to direct that conversation down that road. This is Margaret in Brighton. Go ahead, Margaret.
Hi. I was moved to call in when I heard someone else calling in about be the person who saved someone. When I was in my first year of medical school, I had a friend who I thought was fine, And we actually were skipping class once, and she started telling me how distraught she was. And then the next day told me that she had the means to take her life and blah, blah, blah. And I called the dean. I took some action. And she was, of course, quote-unquote, saved. She was hospitalized. And I earned from her forever enmity for that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know exactly. I'm sure her thoughts were very complex, perhaps very embarrassed. But for me, what it felt like, and I'm conscious enough and I work with myself enough to know that, you know, that will just probably be an unresolved something. It was a very closed topic in the rest of my medical school class. So no one spoke to me about it. It was very, and I did hear that she subsequently finished medical school a couple of years later. But it's not always that you are feel so good because you're the one who saved them. And that is, I just wanted to add that complexity, but it's important to do the right thing if you really think that someone is going to move on that. And, of course, she had the means and wherewithal the information to do it. That's all I needed to say.
Thank you for calling, Margaret Chai.
Following up on those warning signs that you might be seeing and having that discussion is so important to take the step. To take the step to talk about it. And so that was a great story where you took that step, you felt it was necessary, and you followed through. It is difficult because there is so much stigma attached to mental health and suicide as issues, as public health issues in the country. So it's really important to, when you see something, talk about it. And if you're wrong, no harm will come of being wrong. And we can talk a little bit more about that if you like, because I think it's just so, so important to put out there.
Well, what a hugely important point. As we head to break, let's take a look at a couple of statistics here. Suicide now the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, but disproportionately higher levels of suicide and attempted suicide in the younger population, 15 to 24, second leading cause of death, 15 to 24. And it's a disproportionately higher number of the elderly. In terms of suicide, nearly a million Americans attempt suicide every year, and now estimated that 5 million Americans are living after having attempted to kill themselves. So you're seeing some of the numbers as we talk about suicide with a very admirable panel here. We're glad to have Joanne Moon here and Joanne's mother, Jean Lansbury. They're with the Yellow Ribbon Suicide Prevention Program, and Shai Lewis is here. Shai is the manager of 211 Lifeline, a program of goodwill of the Finger Lakes. Short break. And coming back, more talking about preventing suicide next on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're talking about suicide prevention on Suicide Prevention Week, I think we can call it. Wednesday was World Suicide Prevention Day, but we're talking about what to do, how to recognize signs, and then that question that we've gotten from, I think I've gotten at least three different comments on social media, Shai Lewis, from people saying various forms of, I don't want to ask someone if they're considering suicide because it could put the thought in their head. Or, if I'm wrong, you know, what happens to my relationship with that person and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that question that says, I don't want to ask. So I'm going to start with Shai and then ask Joanne and Jean the same kind of question. You know, what do you say to people who are nervous to even bring it up?
The best experts in the field say that it will not plant the idea in someone's head. Chances are it's already there. People, maybe they've already let go of the thought, but it probably has been already there if they're struggling. Probably 1 in 20 people have considered suicide within any given year, maybe rejected the thought, but might still be thinking about it. It's fairly common when things are tough, when stuff seems unbearable, when you're not sure how to get past difficult things. So don't be worried that you're going to plant the idea. There's different ways to phrase it. I mean, I think if you're like, you know, Evan, a lot of things are really terrible in your life. Are you sure you haven't thought about suicide? You know, that's not a good way to say it. That's not a good way
to say
it. Well,
give me an example.
A great way to say it is, you know, Evan, I'm really worried about you. You've been going through some tough stuff this year, and you seem a little bit different, and you seem depressed. How are you doing? You start there, and you start that conversation that just says, I'm concerned about you. I've noticed some differences. I've noticed that you've been going through some tough times. And as I talk to you about that, and you're in agreement with me, maybe you say things like, yeah, I just don't know how to get through this. I might ask you, you know, Evan, some people who are struggling to figure out how to get through this kind of stuff and are dealing with some of the things you've been dealing with, think about suicide. Is that something that you've been thinking about? And then you tell me yes or no. And either way, if I know the answer is yes, now we can start a conversation about suicide. And if the answer is no, now you know that if things ever get that tough, I might be a safe person to talk to. And even if the answer is no, maybe we can still start a conversation about how to cope with some of the stuff that you're dealing with, because I'm still noticing that you're having a hard time.
So the bottom line is, even if the answer is no, there's a productive outcome to that conversation no matter which direction it takes.
Absolutely. Expressing interest and showing your care and empathy for another human being is never wasted. And if you're wrong about suicide being something that they're thinking about, you've really set the stage for if there's ever a future crisis. Let them know how seriously you take their mental health and well-being. And you can offer additional resources whether or not suicide's on the table. So no matter, either answer to the question results in good outcomes. It's really hard for that question to go wrong.
As tough as it can be for people to realize, that's such a great point here. Let me ask Joanne the same kind of question, because I know it comes up at Yellow Ribbon, and when people have these questions, you've been through so much. What do you say to somebody who says, I have such a hard time bringing it up?
It is. The stigma attached to suicide is, it's incredible, and it doesn't help. And I think that as a society, we need to get it out there that, you know, we can prevent it, and it's okay to talk about it. It's not making you lesser of a person, or you're not crazy. And even with the statistics, which are high, I think many of the suicides or attempts go unreported, so they're even higher. Mm-hmm. And then with the Yellow Ribbon, especially for the younger crowd, and I'll let my mom talk more about that too, but like teenagers, they don't want to talk about anything, much less suicide. I mean, they'd rather be, you know, texting, or if you bring up suicide and they're feeling that way, they're not going to want to go talk to someone. And that's a valuable thing with younger people. They're more likely to tell a friend or a peer than a parent or a teacher. And so the little Yellow Ribbon cards, that's how they started the Yellow Ribbon program. They're just little pocket-sized cards, and you can pass them out. Everyone can carry them. And if someone doesn't even want to say, I'm feeling suicidal, I need help, they just hand the card to the person. They don't have to say a word. All the helplines are right on the card. And I will pass it over to my mom to explain more about that and more about what we need to do about the stigma surrounding suicide.
And Jean, what an interesting point your daughter just made, in that, you know, the older we get, the less we relate to teenagers and on all about all things, right?
Definitely.
But I mean, getting teenagers to open up about this, it's probably a different equation, and I haven't thought about it that way until she just brought up that point.
Mm-hmm. It is. And it amazes me, because when you say, well, we don't want to talk about it because it might cause suicide.
Yeah, right.
We talk about cancer, and talking about cancer doesn't cause the disease. So we have to be open and able to talk about suicide. We've been at events where we presented the materials for Yellow Ribbon, and, you know, people walk by our table looking out of the corner of their eye. So at these events, we actually take our information to them. we leave our information table and go to them. A lot of young people will tell a friend and ask them to please keep it a secret. You do not keep it a secret. You do not make a promise like that to anyone.
Yeah, and that's such a hard part. And by the way, it's yellowribbon.org is the website. You can learn more and see exactly what Gina Joanne are talking about and how to pick up cards. She's holding a card right here that I see with the yellow ribbon. If you've ever seen a yellow ribbon, you might not have known what it's for. Now you're learning about that. But, boy, what a point, Gene, because I'm sure once in a while there have been cases where people say, I will tell you about this, but keep this between us.
Definitely.
And you're saying, unfortunately, you can't do that.
No, you cannot make a promise like that. We can't save the world, that's for sure. We certainly can't save everybody. But to keep a secret like that and then to have something happen to that person, it would be just regrettable guilt on the part of the person that tried to keep that secret. And the yellow ribbon card simply says on one side that the ribbon is a lifeline, and it carries the message that there are those who care and will help. If you are in need of help and don't know how to ask, take this card to a counselor, teacher, clergy, doctor, parent, or friend and simply say, I need to use my yellow ribbon. And then on the back of the card, it tells that person who receives the card what to do. Be a link, save a life. And if you've received this card, it is a cry for help. You stay with the person, you are their lifeline. You listen, really listen, and take them seriously. And you get or call help immediately. And as Joanne says, it does give the 1-800-273-TALK lifeline number. You know, everybody thinks that they can't do anything to help because they can. What they would offer to do would be so little. But if you are capable of sharing a hug, if you are capable of listening, you are capable of being a link and saving a life.
Before I get back to the phones, and Mike and Aranaquit, we're coming to you next, so just hang in there if you could. Let me kick it back over to Shai, because Joanne and Gene made some very important points on a number of levels. Number one, 15 to 24 has a higher rate of suicide, second leading cause of death. And Joanne brings up the fact that it's hard to talk to teenagers about anything sometimes. Do you talk to them differently if you have to talk to them?
We don't talk to them differently necessarily, but they certainly talk differently to us sometimes.
Could be harder to break through, maybe?
Just differences in how teens want to talk. They want maybe a little bit more guidance sometimes. Teens don't pick up the phone to call our hotline nearly as much. But what they do is come to our online chat programs. We at 211 Lifeline have an online chat program. So you can go to our website and find it there and be able to instant message. And that feels safer to a lot of people. So we have that program available. The 1-800-273-TALK number that Gene mentioned is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which works all over the country. Locally, those calls ring here to 211 Lifeline. They also...
So you can just pick up and call 211 here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But the other number works. It'll direct you to us. We're so accessible in so many different ways. We also work with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline for their online chat program. And so 211 Lifeline is answering chats from around the country through the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline webpage. So we talk to tons of teens. And that's an easier way for them to reach out and talk. It's an easier way for a lot of people. I wouldn't want to judge that there's an age range because we talk to I got a backup call about someone who was 66 on our online instant messaging program last night. But all age ranges, but primarily teens and young people, that's my preferred way. And I'm not young anymore by any means. My preferred way to talk is through instant messaging or texting. So those programs are available. There's a texting program called Crisis Text Line that's available 24 hours a day, another national program. Any way that it's easy for you to reach out if you're struggling, call 24 hours a day. You want to hear a voice. You want to connect. Call. You want to instant message, 211lifeline.org or National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, crisis text line if you want to text. There's lots of ways to reach out. So don't let being afraid to talk or not necessarily wanting to go someone to see someone face to face be something that stops you from reaching out.
If I'm concerned about someone in my life who may be considering suicide, can I call 211?
You can contact 211 through any of those means that we just talked about. You can contact us. We get a lot of family member consultation calls. I'm worried about my son. I'm worried about my mom. I'm worried about my boyfriend.
Yeah.
And we get a lot of those types of, we call those third-party calls.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll walk you through a suicide risk assessment as best we can. What do you know about their risk? What do you know about their coping skills? What do you know about their resources? And help you make a plan of action to try to get that person help or help you decide if it is past the level of crisis and move to emergency and when to make that decision to contact 911. We can help you with that if you're not sure where to start. And plus, we can be there to give you some support as a caregiver as well, because you might be struggling through all this as someone who loves someone who's at risk of suicide, and you might need a little reinforcement,
yeah.
And we're able to do that as well.
And again, before we get to the phones, Mark online wants to know, if you're going to ask someone about suicide, is it better to do it on the phone or in person?
Either is okay. It depends on your relationship with the person. You know, if your relationship with the person is a face-to-face type relationship and you really connect that way and you have the ability to go see that person face-to-face, that's a powerful statement about how much you care. If the best way for you to contact them and the quickest way for you to contact them is over the phone, reach out over the phone. Neither way is bad. It's more important that you just start the conversation,
yeah.
However you start it.
And Shai, same thing that Jean brought up, when people say, I want to confide in you. You can't tell anybody I'm feeling this way. I've been going through a lot. You know, I got to trust you with this.
And we get that on the hotline even when folks are very concerned. This is so difficult. A person may have been thinking about it alone and not sharing those feelings. And so the first time they share that with someone is really scary. And they want to feel like they can trust you. So they may ask you to not tell anyone else or to keep it a secret. And they're afraid to be embarrassed. They're worried about the stigma. What we try to tell folks is sort of that difference between, we're not going to broadcast your news. I'm not going to tell everyone. I'm not going to tell your friends or family. You know, I'm not going to make a huge production of it, but I can't promise to keep it a secret if I might need to tell someone to keep you safe. And so you try to make that distinction between, I'm not going to embarrass you with this information. I'm not going to broadcast it or blog about it or post about it on Twitter. But I can't tell you that I can keep it a secret, because there may come a time where I need to tell someone to help save your life.
Let's get back to the phones. This is Mike in Irondequoit. Mike, thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for a long-needed discussion. One of the things where I'm a retired teacher, and I have been approached in the way distant past by suffering students, and I always answer the request for secrecy by saying, you're really important to me. If you don't call for help by tomorrow morning, I will, because I could never live with myself if I stood by and something bad happened. And that usually that kind of pushed the action so that help was sought. But that's not why I called.
Okay. Go ahead.
I called because, as the parent of a drug addict, I have taken to the look of drug addiction as a form of low suicide. Especially after a tremendous number of repeated relapses. And in part, I hold the insurance industry partly responsible for this, because they misallow so much needed treatment. 28 days now, down to, I think it's 21 days, maybe enough to get the drugs out of the bloodstream, It doesn't get it totally out of the brain, and it certainly doesn't allow for the treatment of what addicts call stinking thinking to be worked on. That could take sometimes 3 years, and the insurance companies will have absolutely nothing to do with it. Many of them say 21 days, and that's all you have for this year. Some of them have that as a lifetime cap. Hmm. So your thoughts on that?
Well, Mike, thanks for the call. You know, that's a hard one, I know, Shai, but how would you answer that question?
I think as a country, we don't yet have parity with mental health services, with other illnesses, and that there is a struggle. I hear anecdotally, I'm certainly not an expert on the law or insurance companies, but we hear anecdotally all the time about caps and limits on treatment that are making it hard for people to continue to do the things that they might want to do to stay healthy and to stay well, and that there is a discrepancy between mental health services and other kinds of needed medical treatment. Also, we hear sometimes about what seems like unnecessary silos between addiction treatment and mental health treatment, and kind of kicking the hot potato back and forth. Well, are they suicidal because they're addicted, or are they addicted because they're having mental health problems, and kind of getting punted around? We can't take you into rehab because you're suicidal, and back and forth. We hear about that from time to time, and it's frustrating, those difficult silos and the politics of it all. And I can't begin to say I'm any kind of expert, but that frustration that Mike experienced as a parent. So it was something that's echoed on the hotline that we hear.
Keith and Victor. Go ahead, Keith. Thanks for calling.
I have an involvement in the EMS field, and we have a term that we use. It's called a gesture suicide. Is your guest familiar with that at all?
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about, Keith.
So we seem to have those, especially with younger people who get into arguments with adults who, the call comes in, it's like suicide, and when you push comes to shove, they took 10 Flintstone vitamins because mom took away their phone.
Yeah, the when we talk about a suicide gesture, usually someone's referring to a person who maybe didn't intend to die through their actions, but intended to communicate how much pain they were in. The danger when talking about gestures is that we may minimize the seriousness of their pain. Maybe they didn't intend to die. They knew that they weren't taking enough pills to die or something like that. But their pain is just as real as someone who did intend to die through their actions. So we try to take that seriously. And that person is trying to communicate. It may not be the best communication method, but the person who does that is trying to communicate, I'm in a lot of pain here and I don't know how else to deal with it.
Sometimes, from our point of view, it's not as much as pain, it's more as anger. That, and the classic example, and we see this more than you can imagine, the 15, the 14, the 16-year-old who gets their phone taken away because they did something wrong.
Yeah.
And they're just angry, and this is how they lash out.
And I think you might be seeing that last trigger, Mike. My guess is that there's probably a lot more going on for that kid.
And to the caller's point there, if they're trying to do it as a way to send a signal and wound somebody, but not actually kill themselves, that may make it even more difficult for the person on the on the receiving end of that wound to talk about it. But you still have to, because what you're saying, Shai, is they may not intend to kill themselves, but they may still be in pain, and you don't know where they are, and you still have to talk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a very, very difficult one. Let's take one more quick call because I know we're starting to run out of time, and I appreciate all the calls this hour. This is Peg in Rochester. Go ahead, Peg.
Hi, Evan. I'm a grief therapist, and I've been listening and very familiar with this subject. And the word commit needs to be omitted because suicide is not a crime. It's a disease. And I notice in working with suicide survivors that there's so much stigma attached to this. And by removing that word commit and saying they died by suicide, just like they died from cancer, it will take the stigma away.
Thank you for the call, Peg. You got two thumbs up very quickly from Joanne and Jean there. Jean, you first there. Yeah, it was a very vehement reaction to that comment.
Yes, that is certainly the case. Criminals commit crimes. People who die by suicide are not criminals. And we need the media to become aware of that. That term is just like hearing nails on a chalkboard to us survivors and those who work in the suicide community. And it's so good to hear someone else say, stop it.
Look, I'm glad to hear this because I didn't know that. I didn't know that that is a hurtful term.
A lot of people don't, and it just like it rolls off the tongue. Like every now and then, I'll even catch myself going to say it, and I don't want that to be perceived that way to society. So it's a very tough one to get out there, but I think it's very important, and it'll kind of change people's perspective when they're looking at that subject.
What do you think, Shai?
I agree. It's been something that's been rumbling around for the past few years and kind of hit a groundswell where those of us who work in suicide prevention are making a conscious effort to change our language because it can be harmful to survivors. It does. Words have meaning and words can hurt, so those connotations are important. But it is so common. We let some materials slip out this week that had commit instead of complete suicide on them because my eye ran right over them as we proofed the information. Because it's so common. So we're working together to improve the language that we use about suicide, and that's going to improve the conversations that we can have.
Die by suicide. Jean is nodding there. Jean and Joanne have shared not only a great resource about the Yellow Ribbon Suicide Prevention Program, but also their thoughts on a very personal and difficult story. And I admire you both, and I appreciate you taking the time to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Shai Lewis, manager of 211 Lifeline, a program of Goodwill of the Finger Lakes. One more time, Shai, if they want to find you and get help.
In the Finger Lakes region, it's as easy as dialing 211 or 211lifeline.org.
And as you heard her say, if you prefer to be online, there's great resources there as well. Very important hour. Thank you, Shai.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time, and to you for listening to the engineer, John Andrus, today. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a good weekend. We'll see you Monday. This is Connections on member-supported public radio.